in my heart. Wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we're so glad you've chosen to tune in to DLC. Your downloadable commentary for the week, delivered the way we love it to be, and that is completely free thanks to our sponsors this week, Squarespace.
Squarespace!
Squarespace brings the show to you. DLC, of course, the show all about games in their many forms. Games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles. Also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm your host, Jeff Cannata. That's spelled with two N's and one T. And I am joined, as always, by my friend slash co-host slash nemesis. The guy who makes all of his announcements in front of a lumber company, Mr. Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian.
Happy new console week to you. Happy new console
you
week.
You remembered.
To you. I think it was a landscaping company.
Landscaping
next
or
to
lumber,
a store I can't mention on this show and a funeral home.
Happy new console week, everybody.
Oh my gosh, our last episode before the generational change. It does feel like a generational change week. It's the last week before the generation changes. It feels like a generational change week. I'm so excited. We have a ton to talk about as we get ready for those new consoles. We got news, we got games to discuss, but most of all, we have a fantastic guest to do it with. You know, actually, before I even get to that, it's part of our, what I've decided is our November theme month of designers named Alex. That's, we're just doing a whole theme of game developers named Alex. Because, you know, DLC always stands for your downloadable Kanata and your downloadable Christian. This week, we're so excited because DLC stands for designer and lead creator. Because most recently, lead gameplay designer at DICE LA, Alex Solman joins us for the first time. Alex, how you doing?
I'm doing all right, guys. How you doing? I am proper thrilled to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. We're excited to talk to you as well. And it's been a delight. We had last week our first show in November. We had another Alex, game developer, talking to us about game development. I'm so excited to have another esteemed Alex with us. First, my first question to you is: lead gameplay designer.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that to me before we started that that's sometimes called the feel designer, right? The gameplay feel designer. Can you tell me what that is and what you do?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, most games, all games live or die on their gameplay. And a gameplay designer is usually often the primary person responsible for how the gameplay works. What does that mean? Well, that means everything from the response to the buttons, the systems that allow you to do the things that you want to do, to the tuning and the balancing of how that experience might play out. It's often called the feel designer. I often call it the feel designer because the game feel is something that I'm obsessed with. I'm obsessed with how all games feel, not just the games that I'm lucky enough to work on. And so, it's the job that I do invariably is a very cross-disciplinary job. I get to work with animators and engineers and other designers to kind of build the very core of the way an experience feels and plays. It's something that I've been lucky enough to do, for 20 odd years now. Not all of that as a designer, but, a lot of it as a designer. And, how the game feels on the controller or on the mouse and keyboard, how the game responds and what actions you're allowed to do, at a micro level and a macro level are often, within a gameplay designer's remit.
Potentially annoying question, Alex. And if you can't answer, I understand. I'm not looking for hot goss or secrets, but I feel like in my head, if you just walk into offices and go, make it feel better. without going too deep, because I wouldn't be able to follow, but maybe for our listeners who can't, in the micro, what is that? Because there are certainly games we've all played where it's like, this feels amazing. And I'll do an example so no one else has to. This is my opinion. I'm not putting it on anyone else on this show. Tony Hawk Pro Skater 5 felt awful. Tony Hawk Pro Skater 1 and 2 Remaster felt incredible. So like, what, how do you make it feel better? How do you make God of War feel so good versus a game where it just doesn't connect?
It's a great question. I think it's the funny thing about gameplay design is it's, I don't really think it's rocket science. What it is super attention to detail. So for example, you know, if you are a, I'm just going to use, you know, abstract examples here. If you are a third person action game, then when you press a button, you want the action that you expect to be responsive. And what does responsive mean? Well, it varies, right? It varies on the type of game you're playing. Fundamentally, video games are about agency, right? They're about control. They're about your ability to wrestle this thing, to do the thing you want it to do, and execute the action that you want it to perform. And in a, you know, in a third person game, when I press the button, it's the animation, right? It's the animation that plays out, how quickly it winds up, how quickly it executes. It's the sound effect. It's the flash on the UI. It's the it's the sound effects and visual effects and all of those. And then it's also the response that you see on the other side. So when you hit something, it's the way that responds, the animation it plays, the sound effect it plays, the reaction animation it plays, where it goes, how it flies. And so a lot of what you are doing is focusing very much on the minutiae of all of those tiny details. And many of them, often when you play a lot of video games, as I try to do, as with this kind of lens on, it can be quite jarring to play a game where you press the button and the animation doesn't play out quickly, or it plays out for too long. Ghost of Tsushima, for example, is a good example of a game where you can tell that they've got that chemistry that makes the combat and makes the movement and makes the horse and even makes the UI and even makes the opening, some of the menu options feel responsive. It's not necessarily just the avatar on screen. It can be everything from, Kratos' blade swinging to drifting a car to slamming a card on the Hearthstone board. All of those things are fundamentally about gameplay feel, and all of the details and all of the minutiae that comes together to make that button press at that moment feel powerful, feel responsive, feel successful.
It's all those intangibles, it seems to me. And it's interesting because I feel like our role as pundits, as critics, as people who, espouse our opinion for a living, is really tied very closely to your role, mm-hmm. in that I often find myself really having to sometimes struggle and sometimes really be reflective in order to isolate what it is that I like or don't like. What, mm-hmm. why does it feel good? Why does it feel bad? What, you go, oh, this just doesn't feel right. And I think the trick must be in your role to really understand what is missing or what needs to be tweaked in order to make it feel right. And I feel like sometimes I have that same challenge in trying to articulate what is the thing that's missing or needs to be tweaked when I play a game. And I'm just like, I just don't like how it feels. It's got to be difficult, yes?
Yes, you are spot on. It is, I think, a lot of design is about reading between the lines. Yeah, you hear the response to something that you've made, and you often have to kind of interpret that through the lens by which the intent behind the original idea was, or the level by which it's currently finished, or ultimately what that thing was supposed to do. And sometimes the response is very spot on the nose, is on the nose, and you're like, absolutely, yeah, that totally makes sense. And sometimes you're like, well, you didn't understand this because this thing was missing, or it didn't do this the way we know it wants to, or we haven't got to polishing that, and therefore we know we're going to make that better, so it's okay that it doesn't feel great right now. I'll give you an example. There was an animation in one of the games that I was working on, an attack animation, and I worked quite closely with the animator and the engineer and the VFX and sound effects guys to get it in. And everyone complained that it was too slow. It felt too slow. In other words, when you press the button, it took too long for it to actually hit the thing that it wanted to hit, and it took too long to cancel it or get out of it. And what we did to fix that was we actually slowed the animation down. We actually made the move longer. But what we did was we made it that the minute you press the button for the very first time, those opening frames that would play before the actual impact point occurred, we actually animated them in a much more kind of accelerated fashion. So the arm pulled back very quickly and held, and then slashed down very quickly and held. So it was more what we call pose to pose, rather than being a kind of linear animation, a more physically accurate animation that might have been mocapped, where it kind of pulls the arm back, swings and hits. We sort of exaggerated it in all the right ways, and then we actually dragged it out by an extra 10 or so frames towards the end to make it a fraction longer. And all the response we got back afterwards was this feels so much faster, this feels so much better, it's incredible. And in the background, me and the animator are sitting there with our devious fingers going ha ha ha, we know that actually we made it longer, but right. What we did was we solved the complaint, which was doing the animation didn't feel powerful enough, it didn't feel responsive enough. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. There are a load of intangibles there that are, you know, require a lot of experience. You know, I'm fortunate enough to have learned from, you know, the best, working on God of War, working on a couple of God of Wars, and learning the ways and the tricks basically, and all these details that as they come together can make things go from being very clunky or janky to feeling very fluid. And ultimately what you're trying to do is get the controller out of the player's way. You know, a lot of designers talk about this, about feel and flow, you know, finding ways where you're just in the zone and you don't even really notice the controller. And every yeah. time you get jarred out of that is a failure on a gameplay designer's part, I would argue. You know, you've and some games do it, they're okay with it, right? Some games are just okay with it being clunky and loose and not particularly responsive, because they've got bigger fish to fry, and that can be okay. There's games that I've played that, you know, make me shiver when I look at them because they feel so clunky to me, but they're super fun to enjoy and experience. But I would argue, and there's a couple of stories that I think we could talk, or a story in particular we could talk about that I think tackles that, is if you can nail the feel and if you can get the controller out of the player's way, your game's going to be better because of it. You know, it doesn't mean that the metagame or the PvP balancing, all the other things aren't going to be wrong. But if you can get the feel right, you're off to a good place.
Now, you mentioned using your experience as a resource in knowing that, you know, slowing it down was the right answer to making it feel like it was sped up. But is it really iteration and experience? I mean, are you trying a lot of things, or do you not have the luxury to be able to try a lot of things in those situations?
No, it's definitely about iteration. Yeah, I think one of the things I always try and do as a designer is try and I often call it a North Star, right? I try and put a North Star out and go, I think it needs to be this, and let's prototype it and sort of get it in game and get it on the controller or get it on the mouse and keyboard as quickly as we can, so that we can figure out whether that is the right answer. And because ultimately, you know, every game is a recipe and every recipe is different. Even when it's a sequel, you know, when it's a sequel, yes, you've got a lot of base rules that, you know, you can rely on. The box is somewhat defined that you're working within. But you're still going to make fundamental changes. And the minute you make a fundamental change, it has ripple effects across all the other systems in the game. And so, yes, I my most recent gig at Dice LA, which is a studio that thrives on iteration, like we were very focused on gameplay first and building everything, you know, really rapidly. And I think that is a very powerful way to discover this kind of stuff, because yes, it's part experience, but it's also, you know, what the recipe currently is for that experience that you're trying to build or that you're trying to hit. And as I said, I don't want this to necessarily only focus on an avatar or the player character or the vehicle. It also refers to the UI and the menus and the how quickly the game boots up, how quickly it goes, you know, through loading screens or how quickly, you know, even tips on the screen, how quickly they move. You know, every single time a player presses a button and expects a response is an opportunity for a gameplay designer to make it better. And I think that's something, you know, it's not always gameplay designers that do it. Sometimes it's UX designers. Sometimes, you know, it's other designers that do it too. But fundamentally, gameplay is the principle by which everything, you know, rides on. And therefore, the more you can make it smooth and responsive and reliable and readable, and, you know, especially when you start talking about PvP and, you know, understanding what your opponent's doing so that it doesn't feel like they're cheating. And, you know, there's so many ramifications and so many minutiae. Like you said, it is all about those small little things and them all adding up to make a good experience.
Is there someone in your role on every game, or is it more just big teams?
That's a good question. I I think the big teams are lucky enough, you know, when I worked at Santa Monica, there were, you know, I can't remember, maybe six combat designers, right? And all we did was build the combat game systems and the combat gameplay for Kratos and his opponents. And that was our entire focus. And then there was a separate group that did level design. There was a separate group that did, you know, kind of tech design and UI design. So we fundamentally, we built the combat for that game. Other games I've worked on, you know, the very first game I designed on, I was the only combat designer. I was the only, you know, there was only two designers on the project, and I was building the gameplay design. And, you know, and designers often tend to wear many hats, especially in smaller projects. So I think, yes, larger teams have the luxury of being able to be more specialized with their roles and with the, you know, within the design craft, within all crafts, but certainly within the design craft. But I think that, like I said, I would argue that gameplay design isn't rocket science. I don't think that I am a genius. I think I'm just a nerd for details. And I think I'm someone that is obsessed by, you know, I play a lot of driving games, right? Driving games are one of my favorite genres. And I think the reason for that is because driving games are a really good demonstration of player agency, right? That vehicle is in constant control. You have constant control over how much that car accelerates, brakes, drifts, does whatever it does. And I would argue it's similar for FPS games, right? A lot of people outside of the industry like to call a sociopath because we like shooting people in the head all the time. But guns are fundamentally a very responsive vessel for gameplay, for agency, right? When I press a button, I get a very clear response of the weapon firing and things happening, and a very clear response on the other side of whether I hit or missed or a result. You know, it's a two-stage process. I press the button and it's the result that follows that determines whether I feel good or bad or understand what happened. And I think, you know, weapons in general are a very easy to get, very quick to draw satisfaction from action, and therefore I would argue that's one of the reasons why FPSs are in general a popular genre, because at our core we want to be in control and we want agency over the game, and you know, weapons are a very immediate way of getting that. So I've spun on a tangent slightly there.
No, great.
But yes, I think that if you're a larger team, you have the luxury of being able to specialize. If you're a smaller team, there's lots of designers that can do this thing as long as they're thinking in this mindset of, right. I like to say that I always try and think about the player experience, and I'm an experienced designer at thinking about it from that perspective and trying to interpret everything that the player is going to do and make it fun and make it enjoyable and make it satisfying or make it challenging or make it difficult. You know, it depends on the context, but that's kind of what I try and do.
So cool, man. You mentioned in the last little bit there that part of your job is, you know, tooltips and loading screens and what that experience feels like. And as Christian mentioned, we're on the cusp of this new generation where, you know, there are going to be shorter, if not eliminated completely, loading screens. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what you are excited about with this new generation of consoles as a developer and specifically as a gameplay developer.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, as a gameplay developer, I'm certainly excited about the DualSense. You know, feedback is, you know, and tactical feedback on what you're doing is an important avenue by which the player can feel empowered and get control. And early word is that the DualSense is pretty rad, so I'm definitely excited about that. I think from a general designer perspective, from my perspective, the loading times are exciting. I think, you know, the ability to go almost back to the cartridge days where things can just be, you know, immediate. And I think, you know, Alex last week talked very eruditely about that idea of, you know, not losing immersion and, you know, staying in the flow and, you know, not being broken out by, you know, loading screens and jarring. I think, if I'm honest, I think a lot of games these days have already solved that. Think about Tsushima, right? You know, there's one very super ridiculously short load screen. How on earth they do that at the start of the game? And then you never see a load screen again. I mean, yes, when you fast travel, you see a brief one, but, you know, and I suppose you could argue, well, we can take that out. So that's nice. I think that is going to help. I don't know if it's necessarily going to revolutionize things, but I'm excited about it. What I would say is one of the things I'm the most excited about the next gen is, if you think about the open world games that we have today, right? they all have to store a certain amount of square footage, you know, or even square mileage in memory at any one time. Obviously, depending on the speed by which you as a player can traverse that world, they have to have a large portion of the world in memory all the time so that they can seamlessly stream in, you know, way ahead of you the next thing that you need. If you think about the load times that the new gen, increased memory too, but the load times of the new gen, in theory, and I'm not technical enough to be sure about this, but in theory, you could shrink that square footage quite dramatically and take all of that detail that you might have in that large area on current gen and compress it into a much smaller space, because you can stream in the next thing so quickly. And especially when you think about Unreal Engine helping with a lot of the LODs and a lot of the kind of job that is needed to sort of scale visual geometry down so that at a distance it's not taking up too much rendering time. You know, if you think about compressing a lot of that space and the density by which you could now build these spaces, both in, you know, avatars, people, vehicles, clutter, objects, things collapsing, you know, AI, all these things that you can now cram into a smaller space because you can load everything so much quicker. That, as a designer, gets me very, very excited, because there's a lot more opportunity to have gameplay within a smaller space because of the density increase. And, you know, I'm hoping that some of the new games that are starting to build new engines and push forward with new technology will really be able to leverage that idea of being able to store so much more data in a much smaller space and load it in very quickly. And, you know, I mean, I'm excited about the way in which the worlds that we play in will become more involved and dense and detailed and, you know, and interactive potentially too. You know, it's that to me is one of the things that excites me.
Dude, that has gotten me very excited just in talking to you about it. I mean, the idea that we have this next layer of density that we haven't even experienced yet, because things can just get more concentrated into a smaller section because that's all that needs to be in memory at any given time. That's pretty awesome. And I mean, just looking at how dense games are now, you know, going to the next level. And I like the idea that perhaps that means that worlds will feel less like static diorama that I'm walking through, and more like things that are alive, and every little object is, even if it's not super important, is interactable, and you know, that it just feel interactive, I should say. And I don't know, I think that will bring more life to these worlds and make them feel more vibrant and real.
Yeah, I hope so. And you know, I think there's a lot of design challenges there, because, you know, more cluttered, you know, and more stuff does not necessarily make for a better experience. But
right.
I think having that, you know, having that in our arsenal and being able to kind of, like you said, you know, really ramp up that detail. And then if you also think about, you know, the other thing that a very renowned programmer, Mike Micah, was talking about on a podcast I was listening to recently, ray tracing is a really interesting thing, right? It's going to allow us to make visuals much better and improve. You could argue to a certain extent we've been cheating that for a while. Now we're doing it for real, and therefore it's going to look more responsive and more reactive and more dynamic. But at the end of the day, you've got a million rays, you know, bouncing around the world, intersecting between all objects. There's a lot of data you can draw from that, right? You can draw those interaction points and understand what the material types are, or understand what the physical properties are of each thing. And in theory, we've got so much, we can pull so much more data from the world through rays than we might normally do, or might be able to do without rays. And that's something that really blew my mind when he started talking about that, because I'd only been thinking about ray tracing in terms of, yeah, it's going to look pretty, but now they're talking about ways that it could allow us to extract more information from the world around you and deal with, you know, and understand more about what's intersecting with what, hitting what, and you know, that sounds really interesting to me, and could lead to an increase in the level of world fidelity and interaction fidelity and physical fidelity of the world, which could be really exciting too.
That's incredible. I don't know. I'm not even sure I'm wrapping my head around that, but the idea that delivering not just the direction of light, but literally information about the world is delivered in the same way that rays are traced around the environment. Is that the idea?
Basically, yeah. Because I mean, the way again, I'm not an engineer. I'm a Fisher Price coder at best, is what I always say. but when a ray intersects with a piece of the world, right, you've got to draw the material from that in order to understand its reflective capabilities, and you know, to make it look physically accurate, that it's about the light bouncing off of that object and the materials and the nature of what that object is. But if you could also, you know, extract from that information about what the physical properties are and how those rays are bouncing and how the thing that you're firing or throwing or driving or bouncing is intersecting with the world, you're pulling in so much more data. I read a story about, I forget what university it was, but there was a university that did an experiment with a pinball game, and they had a pinball that was firing out millions and millions of rays, and they basically built a physics engine and built a pinball game with a pinball that was just ray casting, using ray tracing to bounce, to understand where in the world it was and what it was intersecting with. And they basically built a physics engine in 50 lines of code, they said, because all it needed to do was say, fire out these rays every frame and tell me what the world is telling you about where it is. And again, I'm the same as you. I was a bit like, I'm not quite sure if my brain understands that, but something about it sounds incredible and I want more of it. So I'm hoping that as we move forward and move past this cross-gen, this cross-gen period and into more, truly next-gen experiences, we'll be able to leverage some of those new things to maximum effect.
Yeah. If that's what's so exciting about being on the cusp of a new generation of hardware is, you think back to what the first few PlayStation 4 games were compared to The Last of Us Part 2. It's like that's the journey we're about to start in this new generation. Is things are exciting now, but it's where we're going to be in 3-5 years time. It's going to be really, really cool.
All I heard is that we were right last week when I said ray tracing's great. Like, that's all. I think that I tried to distill it down to
I've been anti-ray tracing this whole time. I want to ask you one more thing before we get into the meat of the show, Alex. We've been talking a lot about crunch and all the stuff with CD Projekt Red and Cyberpunk and not just that studio, but across the entire industry, crunch has been a real issue that we've speculated on, and Christian and I talk from a position of not being developers, and I think it would be useful if you're able to talk about it to get your perspective on crunch and what that culture is like, and whether we're right to sort of judge it and deride it as being something that should be avoided. What's your position, and what do you think we as consumers should do about it?
It's a great question. I have a lot of thoughts. I'll try and summarize. I've definitely done my fair share of horrendous crunch. I mean, I've worked multiple 100-hour weeks on projects, to get them over the line, and crunched for 6-8 months, six, seven days a week, 16-hour days to try and get things finished. I'm older now. I have kids. I'm not as young as I once was, sadly. And crunch is a burden on our industry, I would argue. I think that there are lots of projects that struggle to finish and force, and I'm not talking about any projects in particular, just in general, force their staff to bear the brunt of that. And I will say that my previous studio, Dice LA, was one of the most progressive studios I've ever worked at thinking about this problem. And they tackled it in two very smart ways. One, there is science that proves that working, as far as I understand, more than 2 weeks of excessive hours ultimately leads to a law of diminishing returns, because you get tired enough that you start, not working as focused as you might be. You start making mistakes, and ultimately those long extended sprints of consistent crunch lead to less than you might get if you worked in a more focused way. But that's not to say that crunch or a very focused attention for a longer than you would normally do in the day isn't a motivator, right? It is. It can breed a level of camaraderie with your teammates. I mean, the guys that I went through on God of War Ascension that had a lot of crunch, I made really good bonds with those people, right? We're in the thick of it, and we're up against it, and we're at the office at 2 in the morning sitting and joking, eating our company paid food and trying to get the thing finished, right? There is a level of camaraderie that comes from that I think is important in what is frankly a passion and team driven, you know, job. There are examples of games that are made by one person, but when you get into these large, you know, even 8, 10, 12 people from up, there's a level of camaraderie that is needed, trust. You know, it's a lot like a sports team. You know, you have to almost be like a family. You have to trust each other and know each other and be able to, you know, lean on each other to get this thing across the line, because you can't do it by yourself. So, you know, we at Dice LA, we would never crunch, but we would have what we called finaling mode, which were these kind of, you know, stints of very focused time where we would work for about 2 weeks for, you know, about 8 hours with, you know, with the request of no internet, you know, keep your outside distractions to lunch and, you know, and a break in the afternoon. And we would work a very intense, focused period of time to a very specific schedule. We had a specific method by which we would knock off tasks and work on things. And it allowed us to be very productive in a very compressed window. And then we would take a break. And then, you know, maybe a couple of weeks later, we'd do it again if needs be. But we would try and sort of do these very constrained but very focused periods. And that was a very responsible way, I think, you know, of dealing with the realities of, you know, we talked a lot about iteration. Yeah, like you can't predict how long it's going to take you to get a game finished. It is a creative endeavor. It is a creative exploration and discovery. And therefore, things are going to come up and things are going to change and you're going to have to pivot and make, you know, reactions. But leadership was always good at, you know, making calls on when things just had to get cut because it just wasn't going to get to the quality we needed. And, the, you know, our methods by which we were able to finish them were very successful. So I think there are responsible ways of dealing with overtime or dealing with focus requirements. And I'm not saying that any studio that isn't doing this is doing it wrong. They're doing it the way they need to do it. In my experience, I would argue that level of crunch is unsustainable and it is a, you know, it's a short gain for a long fail, I would argue. Mm. And obviously, if you get a giant game, you know, over the line and it sells millions and everyone gets a huge fat bonus, maybe it weren't so bad, right? I've been in that situation right. too, but I've also been in the other situation where I've killed myself for a year and then the game comes out and flops and you're like, well, you know, that was a good chunk of my life that ultimately I kind of enjoyed because frankly, you know, we are passionate people. We are very lucky. I'm very lucky to get to do this job every day. But that does mean it's very easy to lose yourself in it and to, you know, get lost in the work and get lost in the time and forget everything else. And ultimately, this is a job. Ultimately, it will go away. Ultimately, I will, you know, I will have other things as I get older and I've got kids and a fiance and all that stuff. You know, there is life going on around me. And that balance point is super important. And I would argue that many companies now are much more understanding of that because we're all older, right? I started when I was 19. I'm in my 40s now. I'm not the only one that's, you know, been doing this for a long time and has grown up making video games. And so there's a lot of studios and companies that I think realize that, you know, keeping talent and maintaining consistent teams is important. And the health of that team is very, very important. The health of those people and killing them to get something done ultimately is a short-term win. So I think it's changing, but I think it's a struggle.
Fascinating perspective. I appreciate you sharing it. And it's awesome hearing about your role. I can't wait to find out what you're doing next. But let's jump in and talk about the stuff that we usually talk about on the show, starting with Story of the Week.
Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week.
Story of the Week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happen in the world of games this week. You can always submit stories for our consideration by sending us an email to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. It's also where you can send any comments or questions or even reviews of your own for games you'd like to hear us talk about or you would like to weigh in on the show, dlcfeedback@gmail.com. You can also check out our subreddit, that's 5x5dlc.reddit.com, or head over to our Discord, 5x5dlc is the Discord, discord.io/5x5dlc. But Alex, you are our guest, so you get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
Ooh, So I think it's actually a really good week for stories. I think there's two stories. There's one story in particular that's definitely my story of the week, but I'm not going to pick it because I think you guys are going to pick it. And I kind of want to be a little self-indulgent and pick something a little developer focused. And that is Todd Howard talking about the new Bethesda engine and what it's going to do.
Yes, saying that it's going to be a bigger leap than from Morrowind to Oblivion was, which, boy, I remember that being jaw-dropping at the time. He also said, by the way, Starfield isn't coming soon. It's not. It's going to be a while still, and Starfield, we know, is slated to arrive before Elder Scrolls 6, but both of them will be using a new version of their engine. I can't remember what that engine is called. I had it here, but it's interesting to me because those games, those Bethesda games, have a very near place to my heart. I love them dearly, but they made a lot of them on the same engine, and it sort of was feeling a little outdated by the time that Fallout 4 came out, and I think we were all hoping that the engine would get a big boost. So I'm curious, Alex, what you make of these proclamations that it's a bigger leap than from Morrowind to Oblivion, and what you're hoping to see.
Yeah, I mean, I think it sort of touches a little bit on what we were talking about at the start, which is I know nothing. This is just purely a developer guessing, but I feel like
exclusive, confirmed, world exclusive.
I feel like this is indicative of the next gen. I feel like this is a sign that next gen has new shiny things in it. It's kind of things we were talking about before that aren't just these, visual and load time benefits. They are ways in which we can fundamentally change the way we build our experiences. And particularly when you think about a game like Starfield, or you think about a game like Elder Scrolls, these big open world, giant, sprawling expanses of experience. I feel like this is a sign that, it's not coming soon. It's not going to be cross-gen. It's most certainly going to be smack bang on the new gen. That this is potentially an indication of them trying to leverage that new technology in the best way that they can. And, working at a studio where you're building the engine at the same time as trying to execute the game, whether it be a new game or whether it be a sequel, is a huge challenge. Often it's just about trying to get back to where you were, let alone, in terms of tools and, ability to actually build the gameplay that you know you're building because you've built it before. But then also trying to find ways to pull in the new, the shiny and new and the things that the new technology are going to allow. I don't think they'll be the only company building a new engine. I'm sure there's other studios that are thinking about it. And it kind of excites me as a developer to go, ooh, those guys know how to make open worlds. They know how to make, sprawling experiences that have hours of content and, procedural content and, all these kind of things. And what are they up to? I kind of want to know.
Yeah, when you were talking about density in the world in the next gen, the first thing I thought was Bethesda games. Their worlds are already feel denser than most, and to think that is unlocked for them to get to a new level of fidelity and create even more interesting environments to walk around in and explore has me very excited. It's also interesting that Todd Howard also mentioned specifically that their tech stack is different than most in that, they build in a priority for modding. And I love that's carrying over into whatever this new version of the engine will be, and that's still a priority for them, because I think that's one of the things that makes their games extra special and adds longevity to them. You see Skyrim, however many years after it's out, all these people modding in better graphics, better this, better that, changes. I think that's got to be a unique kind of challenge to build that into an engine, but I'm glad that they are taking the time to make that happen, because I think it's one of the things that makes their games so special.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
definitely. Christian, what do you make of this? Are you what would you like to see out of the new engine from Bethesda?
Polish, I think. I mean, it's very exciting, right? Like, this is what and while we have talked about this is not soon, but this is kind of what next gen, the concept, the ambiguous concept of next gen is about, right? Like pushing, seeing new engines, things like that. It's exciting to see what new tech can bring, whether it's this year, 5 years, you know, whatever we're going to get. Jeff, I know you and I get very excited about that. I think for me, it's like sometimes maybe Bethesda, they're so big that there's Bethesda jank is like, well, you know, and I hope that some of that can be ironed out with this new engine. Because again, not a developer, but I would have to assume that some of that comes from the complexity and the scale of the world they're making. And then also whether or not the engine allows certain things to happen and as they interact. An example where they talked about it some was Bungie and Destiny, where it was like, we would have loved to have these hot patches come out, but the way we built our game and the way the engine is, we can't do that. You know, it's not built that way. And so, as you mentioned, Bethesda talked about how they prioritize modding and this, that, and the other. And I hope that they also find a way to allow whatever those inevitable things are that are maybe missed to be fixed quickly and to get that polish out, because I'm tired of like Fallout 76 being good now. You know, like I'm glad it's good now, but I wish it was good when I played it for 20 hours at first or whatever. And so I hope they find a way to rectify that.
Couple of quotes here I want to pull out before we move on because they make me happy. Todd Howard said, it's taking longer than we thought, than we would have liked, but it's going to power everything we're doing with Starfield and Elder Scrolls 6. When people see the results, they'll hopefully be as happy as we are with what's on screen and also how we can go about making our games. Here's the bit that I like most. He says, Howard also said the game is completely single player, but is going to be a long time before it's released. They said they wanted to show Starfield off when it's ready rather than relentlessly teasing the sci-fi RPG for a long period of time. We've seen, obviously, Bethesda do that before, and we both here lauded them for that. I think it's a great plan to just kind of give us a short runway, a short ramp up, you know, maybe 6 months. You announce it at an E3 and release it that holiday. I love that. It sounds like they're kind of more on that page again. And, you know, this idea that, you know, it's only going to be single player. I'm kind of happy to hear that too. I'll be honest. Single player games aren't dead. All right. Christian Spicer, what is your story of the week?
There are a few things I think could be fun to talk about, but I think the biggest story, and maybe this is one Alex graciously left for us to mention, Mass Effect had some big news come out this week. I think it's unfortunate that their community day happened on a day when a lot of other news in the United States also happened. I do think the major news networks, I'm joking here, but waited until Saturday to call the U.S. election so that we could all be on Twitter all day instead of trying to be productive was, was
very nice. Yeah, we could all drink is really what it was. They did this because N7,
yes,
right? They did the N7. Yes, there wasn't any wiggle room for them, no. But I got to feel like even with the N7, you got to go, folks, just, maybe we should rethink the strategy here.
Just like there's the game N+, they could have had N7+, you know, happen on N8. But the news, not to have it be buried any more than it was by the other news, the Mass Effect Legendary Edition has been announced. It is the much rumored, now confirmed, Mass Effect 1, 2, and 3, no 3 multiplayer, remaster, and that little thing at the end, kind of like Dragon Age 4, there's more Mass Effect. There is more Mass Effect being made, and coming in 2021 is this Mass Effect Legendary Edition. Are you going to dive back in? Does this get you excited, or has the rumor been around for so long that you're like, oh, that?
Well, for me, you know, I'm definitely curious. They were very clear to say this is not a remake, as we have seen remakes. This is a remaster. This is up-resing the textures, adding some new effects, faster frame rates, some visual enhancements. But it is not, you know, this is not Final Fantasy VII Remake. This is not Resident Evil Remake. This is the games. So yeah, I mean, it's exciting. And it's something, as you said, that people have been expecting for a long time. And, you know, every E3 for the last 4 years, people have been like, where's the Mass Effect remaster announcement? They waited until the day that everybody was looking in a different direction. But I think it is going to be cool. These are great games. And I can't say that I'm like chomping at the bit to jump back into Mass Effect. Personally, I'm excited for a new Mass Effect game. As you said, they tease at the end. But honestly, I feel like this coming in 2021 means a new Mass Effect is multiple years away. And this is to tide us over. So, you know, yes, great games. I'd love to see them look great again, but hopefully by mid-2021, there's all kinds of new, cool, shiny next-gen stuff as well. So, I don't know. I like my newest, latest, best rather than remasters. Yeah. But what do you think, Alex?
So talking purely as a fan, I cannot wait for this. Funny, and so I'm a big video game collector. I have a big old collection of consoles and games. And it actually crossed my mind the other day. I kind of want to play Mass Effect 2 again because it's been a while since I played it. And I played it through twice because I played it on 360 and then it came out on PS3 and I played it through on PS3. I kind of want to play it again. And I'd forgotten that they, you know, obviously the rumor had been floating around. And yes, I did miss the announcement because of November 7th. But I am genuinely excited to play a shinier version of this. Whether I'll play 1 and 3, I'm not sure. I'm hoping that it will do the clever thing that the PS3 version did, where they had like the storybook version of Mass Effect 1 and you could make your choices and then play Mass Effect 2 with the choices that you'd made in the first game. And maybe they'll do that for 3, where you could make the choices in 2 and then carry that through in 3. Cause I always loved the, you know, that progression of save game and story. I thought that was super compelling. I guess I'll have to build my FemShep again, but that's okay. I can probably remember her and put it back together again. Cause you know, I always played as FemShep and she was so cool. And so, yeah, I'm pretty excited. I do like to go back and play a lot of old stuff. But I also enjoy playing, you know, some of these remasters and some of these, the shinier versions. So I'm in.
Yeah. And it's coming spring 2021 for Xbox One, PlayStation 4 and PC. And then, we'll have forward compatibility for the next gen for Series X and PlayStation 5. So maybe we don't know yet what kind of next gen-y stuff it'll have. If they'll have a setting for ray tracing, for example, I don't know. But it'll be nice to see that game looking even prettier than it was. It was always a very, very pretty game, for sure.
Yeah, I think the only thing that I do think that spring 2021, as you kind of, it's like, maybe they just can't announce the Series X and PlayStation 5 version of it yet. It just feels weird to finally have the remaster come out and have it kind of be on old systems. I know, again, a lot of people have them. A lot of people don't jump into the new console generation right when it comes out. I understand that. But it does feel weird to not have the announcement be across everything and kind of be like, it's for these, but not for a while.
Yeah. Before I get to my story of the week, I want to thank our sponsor, Squarespace, which has been a sponsor for the show and for me and the shows I've made for so long. I am so happy about that because I've also been recommending Squarespace personally to my friends and family for just as long. The first time I got a chance to use Squarespace, I knew this was the way to build a website. Chances are you're going to need a website if you don't already. You're going to need a website. There's so many reasons that we all need a website. If you want to turn your cool idea into a website, showcase your work, blog or publish content, even selling things. If you have a business, even online business or a brick and mortar business, you need a website. You can sell things online easily with Squarespace. You can promote or an upcoming event, a one-time thing, special projects, whatever the case. Use Squarespace, build it yourself. If you can dream it, you can make it with Squarespace. You don't need to have any special training. You don't need to know HTML. You don't need to hire someone at great cost to do it for you. You can do it yourself with the tools that Squarespace provides because the tools are simple and powerful. They make it very easy for you to just make exactly what's in your head on the screen. You just move stuff around. It's all what you see is what you get. You just drag and drop stuff in. You start with this great template that their professional designers have created. There's a number of them to choose from to start with. And then you just start messing with it, start dragging things in, plopping new images, create the site that you want. You want e-commerce, you want to sell stuff, drop in the e-commerce widget. It's so simple. There's never anything to upgrade or patch. It's all done for you in the background. Everything is optimized for mobile right out of the box. You don't need to worry about that. It's great. They have built-in search engine optimization. Plus, you can buy your domain from Squarespace as well. They have a new way to buy domains. You can choose from over 200 different extensions so you can get the domain that you want. It's really just the easiest thing in the world. And even if you run into any problems, they have 24/7 award-winning customer support ready to help out anytime. So there's no reason not to do it yourself. Make it yourself. Create a website the way you want, and you don't have to spend a fortune. Go over and check out what they offer. Their tool set is super simple. You don't even have to give them a credit card to start building your website. Just go to squarespace.com/Jeff Sent Me. You get a free trial. Like I said, you don't even need to give them your credit card. And then when you're done building your site and you're ready to launch, use our promo code JeffSentMe, JeffSentMe, all one word. You'll save yourself 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. You can buy a domain there as well. Save 10% with JeffSentMe. We urge you to check it out. Really, it's the simplest, the easiest, the best way to build a website. Squarespace.com/JeffSentMe and the promo code JeffSentMe for 10% off. All right, like you guys were mentioning, there's a lot of really interesting stories this week. I think that one I'm going to pick is one that really shocked me, quite frankly. And that is that Pokemon Go, here in the very end of 2020, we still have another 2 months to go, basically, but it has already made $1 billion in just in 2020 alone. Now, Pokemon Go, it's right there in the title. You got to be able to go. And yet here we are, a year, 2020, where we can't go anywhere. Most people unable to leave their houses on this planet. And somehow in the first 10 months of 2020, $1 billion in revenue for Pokemon Go. The best year so far for Pokemon Go, with player spending up 11% compared to last year, 30% more than the first 10 months of 2019. To date, the game has earned almost $4.2 billion in global player spending. Holy moly, people like their Pokemon Go, and being quarantined did not stop them from playing it. Now, it's interesting that Pokemon Go did some things to make it possible for players to still go out virtually in the game and not actually have to physically be in a place. They basically updated the game to account for COVID and for quarantine, which I think was very wise of them. But it, you know, it's the number three game in 2020 behind only PUBG Mobile and Honor of Kings as far as mobile game revenue. It's the third most played mobile game by global player spending. Alex, what do you make of this? I mean, Pokemon Go, I think, is a compelling game. It's had a much longer life than I would have predicted, and it seems to be surging now against what I would consider to be all odds, but evidently not. Maybe you have a different perspective on this.
No, I have a similar perspective. It did surprise me when I read it. I can only presume that in many ways, maybe it's, you know, a big up for Geeks and Sneaks, right? Maybe there's a lot of people that have been going on walks and continuing to do their Pokemon Go while they're stuck at home. I hope so, because that at least means some hearts and arteries have got a bit better, as well as Pokemon Go's bottom line. I think so. Pokemon Go has always been really fascinating to me as a developer. It's not, you know, in the realm of games that I've or experiences that I've worked on or been a part of. I was caught up in the craze to start with, but fell off pretty quickly. But there's often these experiences that it can be funny, right? Sometimes as a developer, you work at a studio and you work with a lot of people that are of like mind, and you see these giant things happen, and sometimes you feel very distant to them. You know, sometimes you don't, they're not really an experience that you necessarily play. You know, they're quote unquote a bit more mass market than maybe the kind of thing that you're building. And you can sort of sit there sometimes staring at these things going, yeah, but they made a lot of money. Why aren't we doing that? But then by the flip side, maybe you're like, yeah, but that's not the kind of experience that necessarily I want to build or I want to work on. So all I want to do is consume it and play and understand why people like it. And obviously, I think Pokemon Go is a very unique experience. It's, you know, it is a technically a sequel to something they did before, but with the Pokemon license. But in terms of the experience it's selling and what it allows players to do, it's super compelling and very interesting. And clearly with a franchise that, you know, millions of people love, my kids have relatively recently discovered Pokemon. And I think, like you, Jeff, Pokemon was a little bit too late for me. I didn't really, yeah. I never really got it. And now I'm starting to get it as my kids, you know, vicariously through my kids. And, you know, Jeff, you've Christian, you've talked a lot about how your kids love Pokemon and, you know, and you do too. So, you know, it's kind of interesting to me that this franchise combined with this experience, which you might not think is traditionally what people want to play, but marry those two and, you know, has pushed a lot of boundaries and created a, you know, a different type of experience and seeing people gathered and walking around parks and you can still spot them, right? You still see those people and go, they're playing Pokemon Go, they're playing Pokemon Go, because you can kind of tell the way, you know, the way people move. So I'm just glad that it's still having an impact and that people are still enjoying it and that, you know, like most of the video game industry, it hasn't been slowed down by, ultimately really hasn't been slowed down by COVID.
600 million installs for Pokemon Go, which is a pretty darn good number.
Wow.
Christian, is this, I mean, I think part of this probably can be, you know, comfort food. People need comfort food this year, you know, and this probably feels like pretty good, comfortable, warm, wonderful thing. It's a little surprising to me that nobody really has done the Pokemon Go thing since, right? There's been a few games that have tried to do it, but there hasn't really been another game to take the place of that formula. You know, we've seen a lot of turnover in other games, but this, you know, Pokemon Go still is the only one that's kind of doing this thing at scale that it's doing it.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few others. I mean, there's Harry Potter and some others that I could rattle off. And but I think it's similar in other genres as well, right? Like there's League and you know, some of that. There's Dota. There's Fortnite and PUBG. So there's kind of like two and things. But it's like there's World of Warcraft and then a bunch of other things that happened along the way. But there's kind of one that dominates that airspace in a big way. And I think Pokemon Go is a great IP that lends itself to the action you're doing in the game, kind of like how Alex talked about, like, how does it feel? Well, that's what you do. You go around and you collect and catch Pokemon and explore a world. And now I'm able to do this in the real world and interact with them. It kind of has that je ne sais quoi element to it that's like, yeah, Harry Potter, this is my opinion, but it's not built around exploring a world looking for trinkets and tokens. Like, that's not that game's or that game's. That's not that book's narrative. That's not its through line. This is literally the bulk of what Pokemon is. It's collecting, catching, exploring a world. And maybe it's just because I live kind of in a suburban area of Los Angeles. I do see a lot of people playing it as that's kind of one of the things they can do is masks on, walking, going around at the park, you know, like on the trails and stuff like that and playing Pokemon Go. And I think it's a testament to smart design, in addition to the IP, smartly designed IP by people that know what they're doing and are willing to put their passion behind something. They, after COVID hit, they found ways to make the game work in this new reality, and they embraced that style of the game and what it could be. They're committed to building community experiences still in a safe and fun way. And you don't hear about it in like you do a lot of other games, certainly, but also a lot of mobile games, and how it exploits its user base. You don't hear stories about predatory pricing. And it can be expensive, but it does these things in a way that, in my opinion, feel good and aren't necessarily the FIFA for a console game experience or go to the App Store and pick one other mobile game and kind of predatory pricing and blocking gameplay, I think it's a testament to building your community, believing in your community, and working on something that people get genuine joy from goes a long, long way, coupled with it's literally the thing you do in Pokemon. So it works. It works makes so sense. Well.
Yeah. Alex, you brought several other stories to our attention. Is there one or two that you wanted to bring up here?
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you. Definitely, there's a few I'll rattle through. Astrobot sounds like it's going to be amazing. And it's going to be, you know, some people are saying it's one of the best launch titles ever made, which is exciting and a real love letter to PlayStation, which, you know, sounds exciting. Obviously, there's verdicts floating around on PS5 and Xbox. You know, commentators have their boxes, and some of the big sites like Eurogamer have their boxes and have cast their decision, and it seems like everybody's pretty positive about it. But I would like to be slightly cheeky and bring up two things. One, PT not compatible with PS5. This was a story that really made me both laugh and cry. It seems like that long-running bitter saga of PT continues.
Yeah, the people that still have it installed are crying yet another set of tears.
Yeah,
I gotta pay for my kids' college somehow, and it's with that PS4 with PT installed on it.
Yeah, and it seems like at one point it was compatible with PS5, and it was listed as working on both PS4 and PS5, and people had it running on their
PS5. That's the craziest part. That's the part I don't understand, is like they flipped a switch and said, no, people can't play this. I thought that's wild.
So interestingly, right, I had PT on my PS4, you know, permanently, because I was convinced I would never wanted to lose it. And then there was a stealth patch that they dropped at some point, which disabled it, and it was disabled on my PS4. And I was really upset because it was completely silent, apparently. I mean, I guess maybe there was a notification when it happened, but it was very silent. And so I presume they did the same thing where somebody at Konami went, can't have it happen, quick, disable it again, silent patch. And according to Sony, it was a publisher decision to change it from being PS4 and PS5 compatible to only PS4. So I think it's kind of tragic that what was such a landmark and incredible experience still continues to, stab the knife in a little bit to us fans that were really excited about it happening.
You know, there's going to be some year at some, you know, E3 or some other conference where somebody's going to walk on stage and be like, we're bringing PT to the, and then people are going to go, and there's going to be a whole generation of kids that are like, what is this PT thing? You know, it's going to be
one quick
copy. It's going to be like Shenmue.
It's going to be, it's going to be a Kickstarter. That's
right. Yeah.
And there have been people recreating it in dreams and recreating it in various other places too. So it lives on in the fans' hearts. and then the one other one, which is completely self-indulgent, and I hope you'll allow me the time. There's been a trend lately for these ODES or optical disc emulators that have been coming out. And again, as a retro nerd with way too many consoles, I'm worried about some of my consoles dying, and this, you know, some of the drives, these old, you know, CD and DVD drives are starting to fade. And there's been a real trend lately for you know, basically homebrew people generating these ODES that allow you to swap out the drive and, you know, almost plug and play a new drive in. Christian, I know you've talked about it a couple of times. And there's a new one that's come out for the PlayStation called the X Station, which is almost, it's not quite as plug and play as some of the others, but it's very, very flexible. It's very easy to do. And they, you know, this is how kind of nerdy and how much attention to detail they pay to these things. So the new patch allows a certain number of European only PS1 games that were locked by a very particular anti-piracy measure called LibCrypt to now work. And basically the X Station firmware can decode and decipher and basically pass the message to LibCrypt and say, no, everything's fine here. You're running on a European PS1. It's all good. And allow that to work. And I think ODES and these general, you know, this general trend towards kind of restoring old hardware, putting in a way that allows you to play a lot of the old games still on the original hardware, but with some of the convenience of digital media, I think is such a, you know, a very niche product, don't get me wrong, but it's such a wonderful, I'm so thrilled that, you know, the Saturn, the Dreamcast, the PS1, you know, the PS2, a lot of these consoles have these amazing pieces of technology that crazy people in their garage have managed to figure out and produce, you know, at a level by which you can buy it on the internet from someone, you know, from a company, and actually plug it into your console and keep it going. And I, for one, have already dabbled in some of them and certainly plan to get one of these X stations.
Yeah, Christian, this is right up your alley.
I love it so much, and I think your point, like, I love the way that they're like, the internet, don't get me wrong, I owe a lot of my career to it, but it's a horrible place, but I like these bright spots as well, where it's like, yes, a community exists now because of the internet. There's enough of us that find interest in this, whereas before, you know, maybe be like one person at the swap meet that's like, I have this owed, and be like, I don't care, lady. I don't know what that is. No. It's for your European PS1 games. It's like, no one cares. And now it's like, oh yeah, that's a thing. And I can make money providing it to people, and people working on patches for it for, I don't know how many, no offense, I don't know how many European only PS1 games this is, but it's a small library, and someone put in the hours and time for it. I love it so much.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. And I love a lot of the work that, you know, Digital Foundry does on these, and RetroRGB is a website that I love that talks about this stuff. You know, you're absolutely right. There is a community of people that are thrilled at this idea of, you know, I've bought all the minis, right? I'm a lunatic enough that I have the original games and I've bought the minis because I love the mini hardware. And, you know, I like to play, you know, classic games. I find as a developer, it's a beneficial thing to do, because there are often a lot of games, you know, where there's ideas that you know, I was playing a game I think you love, Christian, Dynamite Heady, just a couple of weeks ago, and I was playing that on my original Genesis, and I didn't realize how kind of like almost not open world, but kind of hub and spoke and kind of narratively driven that game was for, you know, 1991 or whenever it was released. Sometimes you go back to some of these games, you're like, oh man, I can't believe that this idea existed back then. I thought this was either a newer idea or a new, you know, and many of them are evolutions, but, you know, and Power Stone was a game that inspired me at one point to one of the games I was working on, because I love that idea. And, you know, often as a developer, it's useful to pull in some of these older experiences and play them and remember them, and maybe there's ideas that you can pull out and modernize, and or that reflect on ideas that you're doing. There can be good ways of kind of stimulating new ways of thinking about old problems. So,
well, if you need to adopt a kid in their late 30s, I know a guy who's willing to come over and play games with their adopted dad and make them real proud.
I always love to talk retro, mate. So whenever, it's all good.
I'm curious what your feeling about remakes and remasters is, you know, with this love of the old hardware and the old experience. Do you think that, I'll just leave it there. What are your feelings about it?
I'm glad, mostly glad that new people get to experience, you know, games that, you know, I loved at the time or was lucky enough to be around when they came out, and, you know, and people can play them with a new lick of paint. And, you know, obviously when you think about something like Final Fantasy Remake, that is a huge endeavor. Incredible. You know, interestingly for me and for us that worked on it, Medieval, you know, I worked on Medieval, Medieval 1 and 2, and that got remade. And that got remade by an entirely different group of people. I would have loved to have worked on it because it was so amazing. And it was such a weird feeling to, like, know that game so well. I was lead tester on it, so I've played that game upside down and back to front, you know, for months.
Wow.
And to see someone else kind of take it, and that was a, you know, that was a remake, that, or I guess that was a remaster. It was somewhere in the middle where they did remake some of the stuff. And, you know, my friends that did the original music got to sort of redo the music and remaster all the music with new techniques and a new orchestra, and but they sort of stayed very true to the original game but gave it a new lick of paint but added some new bits here and there. And it was a bizarre experience to sit down and play that game and know it so well but feel like someone else had kind of taken it and adjusted it. And I'm sure a lot of the developers, you know, that maybe worked on these games and don't get to work on the remaster have similar feelings. It can be a very strange experience to see your baby kind of taken on, and, you know, and invariably done do such a great job of it. And Medieval was a was amazing. I loved it. So I think I'm kind of torn in two ways, where I love playing the originals and I love playing the originals on a hardware and experiencing the way they were supposed to be. But I'm always curious how they take some of these games on, whether they just give them a fresh lick of paint, whether they refine and tune and what they adjust and change and where. And sometimes it's very minor changes. Sometimes it's larger, you know, larger substantial changes. I find that very compelling. And mostly I'm excited, you know, as, you know, EA talked about, or BioWare talked about in the Mass Effect press announcement, that new people can discover these incredible games that they just don't have the access to now because it's a generation away that, you know, they're not able to. So I think it's going to get blurry when backwards compatibility gets really versatile, and, you know, you can kind of play the old game a lot easier than maybe you can play the remaster, or just as easy as you play the remaster. I think that's when things get even weirder.
And we're getting like algorithms to add HDR to games that never had them and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It is. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about the games that we have been playing in a segment we call the playlist. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us on the playlist. Alex, what have you been playing this week?
Okay, so I'm going to start with a couple of short ones. Initially, Ghost of Tsushima, basically just to seeing more praise on it. I've been playing that game, I think I'm 50 hours into it now.
Wow.
Everything that Christian, you've said about it, I completely agree. I do want to hit on a couple of things that, as a developer, I found very compelling about it. One, I think that the way that it paces its open world is exceptional. What do I mean by that? The number of activities that you get to do is just enough that there's enough that you forget, oh, I haven't followed a bird for a bit, or, you know, I haven't followed a fox, or I haven't found this, or I haven't done that. They're spaced out enough that it's easy for me to kind of go, okay, I'm going to follow the main story and go over here, and then in an ADD way go, oh, shiny, I'm going to go over there, and shiny, I'm going to go over here. But it doesn't happen so frequently. The map isn't so overloaded with so much stuff.
Yes, it's not intimidating. It's
exactly.
I love so many of the Ubisoft games. Sorry to interrupt. And I've talked about some of them over the years, but I do feel like I open up that map and I'm just like, I'm going to go play Sonic 2.
Yes, I completely agree. And I think I pulled a little bit of a Christian on it in that I spent 35 hours in chapter one. I deliberately didn't complete the first chapter's story because I wanted to explore so much of that first part of the island, because I was constantly in a very healthy way, and not in an overly, to your point, overly overwhelming way, getting pulled around by all these side stories and side quests and, you know, ways and the bamboo things and, you know, all these little ways I could level myself up, all these ways I could unlock different parts of the story, all these ways, more importantly, that I could kind of dive into the texture of the world a little bit more. And I think, you know, as many of us are a fan of Japan and a fan of that culture, I think it brings a lot of that. You know, I'm playing it with Japanese subtitles. I'm not playing it in Kurosawa mode. I wish I had, but I'm also glad I didn't, because I'm kind of enjoying, I feel like the Japanese language and subtitles is the best way for me. But I feel like that game, it's very easy to kind of let the game kind of drag me around in the way that I, you know, in the way that I want to, but also in the way that it presents interesting, varied things to me. And now I have got through the first chapter, and now I'm into the second island. I'm kind of the second part of the island. I'm doing the same thing. And just kind of letting the adventure kind of unfold in front of me, and letting my curiosity guide me, which is a very compelling experience.
One last thing on that point. I think the wind is beneficial for that. At least it was for me as well, where it like pointed me to where I was going. But my problem here, I become beholden to an arrow on the ground. And sometimes I want it. Like, there were times with the wind where I would bemoan it and be like, this is a mountain. I cannot go over this mountain. That's the ocean. And then like, okay, enjoy the experience. But if you give me an arrow, like an arrow on the ground, I'm following that arrow. And because Ghost didn't, I did find myself enjoying that exploration a lot more than I otherwise would have.
Absolutely. And drinking in the scenery as well. I feel like I spend a lot of time you know, kind of just enjoying, you know, that traversal. And I very rarely fast travel in it. The only times I really fast travel are when I want to upgrade, because I'll just quickly fast travel, you know, visit the shop and then ride on out of town and carry on. And so, yeah, I agree. Like, I think that wind is, I use it a lot, and I like that it keeps me, you know, kind of focused on the full screen rather than just a piece of UI. Just quickly, I would also like to, again, as a combat designer, it would be wrong for me not to talk about the combat. You guys have already talked a lot about it, and a lot of people have. I think the thing that really impresses me about Ghost of Tsushima's combat, and I listened to a podcast where they talked about it, this concept of stillness in combat. It is something they've talked a lot about. Is very, you know, very apropos of the style they're going for, and the way that they capture it. Two things which you could argue are at absolute odds. The way that they capture it in, you know, in very simple ways, but, you know, ways in which it gives this pacing to combat, it gives this fluidity to your movement, and it almost always makes me want to bow whenever I finish a big combat sequence. I can just swipe down on the touchpad and bow, because it feels like the game is, you know, the game is allowing me to express myself. And if I commit a combo and I swing one too many times, I feel like, oh, I've wasted energy. I am a failure as a samurai. You know, like there's ways that it creates that experience and allows you to role play in it. And some of it is automatic. You know, the way you'll turn at the end of a combat move, or you'll hold the final pose, you know, at the end of the standoffs. You know, some of that is forced, but some of that is the way I will control the character. So I won't necessarily, when that happens, I won't necessarily walk away straight away. I'll let my character stand there and just breathe and be in that pose and be in that stillness. And I think, you know, that is an incredible achievement, and one that would be that, you know, it's hard to fathom just how much iteration that must have taken, not only on the principle of how to get it, but also on the animations, you know, and on the execution of it, you know, the finesse of it. And gameplay design is often about this tension between, especially third person game character design, is often about this tension between animation and responsiveness. You want the game to be very responsive, but you want to leverage the benefits you get of the animation of the character being on screen, to sort of really create that fluidity and that immersion in the world. And I think I've always been a massive fan of Sucker Punch games as a gameplay feel nerd. I always feel like every one of those, I loved all the Infamouses for exactly the same reason. Yeah. They had this flow to their combat and style that was just, it's just magic. And Tsushima continues that, you know, in every way. And I am deeply in love with it.
Wow, that's awesome. Yeah, it definitely feels like the perfect exemplar of what you were talking about as far as feel. That's so cool. Mm-hmm. What else is on your playlist?
So another quick one is Stories Untold, which is actually a game that came out, I think, a couple of years ago on PC, and I guess earlier in the year on Switch, but just came out on PS4. And it's kind of an adventure game. It's actually created, I think it's written and directed by John McKellen, who was quite influential, I believe, in Alien Isolation, which is one of my favorite games of all time. I dearly love that game. And I didn't know that until after I played it. It's got a Stranger Things vibe. It's got the main artist from Stranger Things who did the poster for it. It's this puzzle adventure game. It's this kind of game in a game. It's split into four chapters. It's very 80s, got a lot of synth wave. As a fellow Midnight fan, you know, it got me going with its synthy vibes. Each story is kind of this unique little idea. I won't spoil them because it's very much about the experience, but fundamentally what they are is kind of a text-based, verb-based text adventure. That you're kind of indirectly controlling. This is not a spoiler. The opening story, it's in the trailer, is basically set on an old 8-bit computer. And so you are using shortcuts to basically do the verb style adventure game checking of things. As a British gamer, all the games kind of, that game kind of loads like an old 8-bit tape game with the scrolling screen. So I'm nerding out over the fact that they've captured that. I mean, I believe John is English, so I'm not surprised, but you know, it captures a lot of that style. Each story is very unique. They do connect at the end, as far as I understand. I haven't finished it. I think I got to the third chapter. But it's a really, really polished, very interesting, it's a little creepy, but not overly so. But it's got some really interesting ways in which it pushes the fourth wall, and it uses this interaction mechanic to encourage you to do different things. It's really, really interesting, and I can't wait to finish it. I highly recommend it.
That is Stories Untold, and it looks like it's $10 on Steam, and yes, it's supported on Mac OS even. So lots of opportunity to play Stories Untold.
Yes.
What else you got?
So the next one is Pacer, which is a game that I kickstarted in April 2015. I still can't quite believe that it's finally come out. They were true to their word, and I got my PS4 code through email this week, and I finally got to play it. Pacer is published and developed by R8 Games, who are all ex-Sony, many of them Sony Liverpool, where Wipeout was born. And this is basically a modern-day Wipeout without the Wipeout license. But it does have some really interesting modifications of the Wipeout formula. I am an absolute devout Wipeout fan. I actually, at my previous studio, we had this process called Decons, where somebody would get up and do kind of a presentation on a game that they loved or a mechanic that they loved or something. And I did a whole like hour and a half on the history of Wipeout. I think Wipeout is a hugely influential part of our industry. I think it's one of the reasons why games are where they are right now in terms of its tone and feel, it, you know, and the way it was marketed, and, you know, those early days of PlayStation. I had every version of Wipeout running because I'm a nerd and I have all the games and I have all the machines to run them on. So I had a big setup with everything running. So I'm absolutely biased, right? I love Wipeout dearly. What I will say is that from the minute I picked this game up, the handling is, they've nailed the handling. It feels fluid and responsive and smooth, and it glides in a way that very much like Wipeout Mega Collection did, and the way, you know, the way Wipeout has evolved over time. It's got some interesting modern day things. It's got a loadout modification. You can choose your weapons. So instead of the old model where you would pick up different weapons on the track and use them in situ, you sort of preload the weapons that you want. And there's only one pickup for weapons and one pickup for shields, which I think is an interesting modification. It allows you to kind of both, you know, progress your weapon loadout and also add mods and slowly grow across different ships and have different loadouts. It's an interesting level of progression. The track design is, it captures that roller coaster aesthetic that Wipeout's always tried to deliver. Some of the early tracks are really interesting, and they grow. There's one in particular track where you're floating through this incredible kind of giant, like mega dump, like it's a mega rubbish dump, with these giant crushing machines in it, and it's got huge swooping hills and these giant mounds of rubbish all around you. And it looks beautiful. It's really interesting, and you know, the tracks are spot on. It's got Cold Storage, aka Tim Wright, who did all the music for the original Wipeout and is, you know, still very much part of the Wipeout scene. He's done some original tracks for it, plus they've got a number, I think 80 odd tracks from various different bands, and, you know, to very much capture that kind of electronica. They've got Designers Republic involved, who are, you know, the original curators of the original styling of Wipeout. I think it's, for a game that's been in production from a very small team, it's an incredible achievement to get anything out. I think it's a little bit rough around the edges when you first pick it up, like the tutorial. I went through the first mission of the tutorial, and it sort of trained me about this is how you fly the ship. And there wasn't a single message on screen to tell me how to fly the ship. I just did a two-lap race and went, well, I guess I know how to fly the ship now. But I didn't know what any of the pickups were, what I was getting hit by. You know, I guess all I knew was I had to finish first. I think that's okay, right? You know, I think it's a game that they're still working on. I think it's a good example, I would argue, of where attention to detail can sometimes slip when you're just trying to get something finished. But I think that it does a good job of kind of capturing the essence of Wipeout, but adding a few new additional things with these loadouts, with the, you know, with the curves. It has this boost system that you can do at any time. And it also allows me to sneak in this crazy story about this guy that requested a car be designed like Wipeout, and is going to get a £200,000 special car in the theme of Faizar in the classic Wipeout team colors, which is super cool. If you like Wipeout, if you like AG racing, if you like that kind of thing, I think Pacer is well worth checking out.
Awesome, dude. Christian, I know you've been a big fan of Wipeout. Are you going to check out Pacer?
Yeah, it's a game I've been following on PC for a bit, and I've been sitting here. I did not Google it, but it has a different name when it was on. Do you know what, Alex, what it was called?
Yes, it was originally called Formula Fusion.
Yes.
And that, which is what I kickstarted. And then I think two years ago or so, they had to change it. I'm not sure why, but they had to change it to Pacer.
Yeah, and so now it's out on console. And it's the type of thing where I'm like, this looks so great. I also just really want another Wipeout. Also, there's so much to play right now. It's like not quite what I'm looking for at a little bit of the wrong time. And also, I Wipeout the remaster, or I forget what it's called. Yes, it's a stalwart on my PS4 still, so I'm good.
But especially in VR.
Yeah, so good. But I love that there's that team or folks from that team have worked on this, and I hope it builds, and I hope we get another Wipeout.
Yeah, me too.
We can't let you go without talking about another driving game, right, Alex?
Yes, yeah, driving game nerd kicking in. So
I love it.
My last one is Dirt 5. I am a massive fan of Codemasters. You know, they've been around since, what, 86, I think. I've played so many of their games. One of the reasons I love Codemasters is, one, they create great driving games, but two, I always feel like, again, going back to this kind of idea of feel and response, I always feel like Codemasters games have a level of slickness that often belies their development team, you know, often belies that, you know, they obviously focus on trying to make sure the experiences are slick and polished and responsive. Their menus are always really good. The entrance and flow into the game and getting you set and getting you sort of bought in is always really good. The opening tracks, the opening races. Dirt 5 is kind of a return to the classic origins of Dirt, the Dirt 2, Dirt 3, which I think a lot of fans feel like is probably arguably one of the best. Whereas, you know, the later Dirt 4 started to blend a little bit close to Dirt Rally, which is their other sort of very focused on rally game. This is from the team that are ex Evolution Studios, as far as I understand, who are ex MotorStorm and ex Drive Club, also two of my favorite racing games of all time. Where is my MotorStorm remaster that looks like that 2005 E3 video, that target render? Like, surely we can do that now. Surely, at least on PS4, certainly on PS5, Xbox, you know, Xbox One X, we can, Series X, we can hit that level of visual quality now. But it feels a lot like MotorStorm. It reminds me a lot of MotorStorm. The handling is authentic, but not overly so. The chaos of the track with a number of opponents on around you is very MotorStorm-y. A lot of the undulation in the tracks and the way that, you know, tracks go uphills and downhills feels very much like Drive Club, which had some really interesting track design in it. Some of the off-road, it has a really interesting collection of off-road vehicles, including one known as Formula Off-Road, which are these crazy, like, slapped together chassis buggy things that they drive in Iceland up volcanic mounds of ash. And I only know that because one of the games I was working on years ago, I was working on a driving type experience, and I came across this whole campaign, this whole series of races that happens in Scandinavia and certainly in Iceland around this idea of traction and trying to race these giant V8 vehicles up slippery, crazy slopes. And it's the first time I've ever seen those vehicles in a game, and they're crazy. Wow. And out of control. It also does this really cool thing where it has the party atmosphere of the whole experience, very much like MotorStorm and Drive Club, is there. And it does this. Here's an example, I think, of an attention to detail. When you're in the lit menu screens, there's music playing. You start to load the match or the race, the music continues. And then as you go into the race, the music shifts to be on the PA system in the track. So it goes from being, like, you know, around your head in the menus to in the world as the race. And it's totally seamless. And it's a silly little detail, but it's one that, you know, is a good example of what I'm talking about, this idea of, you know, a lot of people, again, like a lot of people talk about great music, yeah, great soundtracks for movies. You only notice them when they're bad. When these things all come together, it creates this experience that if you step back and look at it and go, oh, all these details really make me feel part of this system and immersed in this world. Cody's games always do that really well, I think. It's got a brilliant narrative campaign that's voiced by Troy Baker and Nolan North going back and forth. It's also got an authentic couple of guys that do a racing podcast, and some of their banter is really entertaining. It's a little cheesy sometimes, but I think they've done a good job of kind of striking that level of they don't take themselves too seriously and they talk a lot between the races. It's going to have 120 hertz mode on Series X, which I'm excited about. It's got split screen. They're keeping split screen. And mostly, so I'm playing this on PS4. It just came out. I'm mostly super excited to play this in 4K on DualSense because I think this game, it already feels like there's some slight creaking. Some of the loading movies kind of stutter a little bit as the game's loading. It feels like there's a few bits in there where maybe it's pushing the PS4 a little bit too hard. And, you know, when it goes to next gen, it's going to sing. One other quick thing, and sort of talking about, we were talking about UGC earlier and, you know, the ways in which developers allow, you know, players to participate. It has this crazy playground mode where players can basically build their own kind of tracks through using set piece objects. It's very Descenders or Trapmania like, and it's already creating some really cool little levels and spaces to play in that are really professional. They, you know, they look really finished. They look like, you know, Cody's made them, and they're super fun. And I think I'm hoping that's going to bring a lot of life to the experience and allow people to keep enjoying this game and playing it in different ways. So I'm a big fan of this game. I'm a big fan of the series, and I think this is a real return to form.
Again, that's Dirt 5, which is I think it's going to be one of the big next gen games, really, honestly. I think because it's this cross gen title, I think people are going to be talking about it as a strong launch title.
Definitely.
Yeah. Sounds like it. Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. Awesome stuff. Christian Spicer, what is on your playlist?
I'm only going to mention one thing because not a lot new this week. I am still Ring Fit Adventuring, and I will say that I love it and I hate it. Like it continues to be a real workout. I dread the days I cycle. Peloton 3 times a week, and I had my first I was in a thing video on demand, a class on demand with someone else from Geeks and Sneaks. That was fun. We did a little high fives.
Awesome.
And I do,
I'm on there too. Geeks and Sneaks, yeah. Hashtag Geeks and Sneaks on Peloton, getting in there.
We were right in the same time, me and someone else from there. I was like high five. And then I Ring Fit Adventure twice a week, and then I run once a week. And Ring Fit Adventure is my least favorite of those because it's hard. It's really hard. So I will continue to talk about that as I kind of finish up my campaign there, so to speak. But I'm going to yield the remainder of my time because while I could continue to gush about Ghost Runner, Jeffrey Cannata, I want to hear about what you've been playing.
Yeah, I got an early copy of Spider-Man Miles Morales. I do not yet have a PlayStation 5, so I've been playing it on PlayStation 4.
Oh, I thought you were going to be like, wait, you can't talk about it because you're not playing.
No, I can talk about it. I can finally talk about it. And everyone who listens to the show knows how big a fan I was of the first Sony Spider-Man game from a couple of years ago. It is phenomenal, and I just think that they nailed so much, honestly, so much of the things Alex has been talking about all show is on display in the Spider-Man games. You know, that this, the feel of swinging through the city is so delightful. It is so exactly what you want. It's that wish fulfillment of being Spider-Man, how you need to actually have something above you to hit a web with to be able to swing, how you swing, the feeling of velocity, the game of the movement and how you can maximize your momentum and use it in various ways and all the different ways that you can be Spider-Man in that game and how the combat works and how it's so kinetic and you really feel like Spider-Man. Yes, of course, borrowed heavily from the Batman Arkham games, but I really loved what Insomniac did with the first Spider-Man. And Miles Morales carries that torch forward. It feels like an expansion and a sequel all at the same time, but also it feels fresh because you've got this new character in Miles Morales, and Miles Morales gets some cool new powers. If you have read any of the Miles Morales comics, you know that his power set, his move set, isn't exactly the same as Peter Parker's Spider-Man.
Objectively better, right? Like, can I go out on a...
Well, yeah, you just add more, right?
Exactly. It's all of them plus better ones. It's
you didn't lose anything. You just got new stuff.
Let's take Spider-Man and add invisibility. Better.
Yeah. And electric shocks, you know? It's pretty better. Cool. And the game does that too. And I think there can be a tiny complaint to say that, like, he's too powerful now. They ramp up the enemies. There are very specifically enemies that, like, cancel out some of his new powers. And I think that was a smart move in the sense that, yeah, he's pretty amazing now, spectacular and web of all at the same time. He is, you know, he is very potent, right? You get into trouble, the wonderful Spider-Man plucking guys from above and webbing them upside down and doing all the stealth stuff now has become even more easy to accomplish when you can be invisible for a period of time. So there are things where the enemies can shut off certain powers, and he's got these venom moves now where he's infused with this bioelectricity that he can, you know, one shot enemies with and do all kinds of new cool stuff, shock people up into the sky and then, you know, stun them so that he can, you can punch them into oblivion. All that stuff's really cool. But then of course enemies come that can turn off his web powers for a short period of time. So it's balanced in a certain way, and the new powers are super fun to use. It is a very, very fun game. But I remember in the first game, for me, my play style was that I loved generating the finishers and then banking them. You know, you could put skill points into being able to bank multiple finishers. And then I would, like, you know, dole those out in specific ways. And that was a lot of my strategy for dealing with big fights, is like how I would dole out my finishers. And I really feel like the finishers are still present and you still can earn them and you can still put points into having multiples of them. But now you've got a lot of finishing moves, basically. You've got these venom moves that work as finishers in a very significant way as well. So I feel like the finishers themselves have been kind of devalued a bit. It's new. It's different. And it's not bad. It almost feels like you're this abundance of riches, that you have so many things at your disposal. You've got new gadgets now. There's all these crazy new gadgets now where you have these, like, holograms that can fight with you and beside you that are pretty rad. So there's a lot of cool stuff. It's still New York City, very beautiful New York City. It feels familiar. Now it's kind of set in a wintry holiday period, which is fun. You get a lot of snow and, you know, Central Park has snow all in it. And it's kind of fun to see that. The game's gorgeous on PlayStation 4, and the load times are extremely low on PlayStation 4, which I was shocked. You know, I know we're supposed to expect basically zero load times on PlayStation 5, but I was getting like 3 or 4 second load times on, you know, on fast travel and on when you die or, you get knocked unconscious in this game, which has happened to me a few times. Back in the game from my checkpoint, from my load, in like 3 seconds. It's incredible and very much appreciated on PlayStation 4. So I can only imagine that those 3 or 4 seconds are zero on PlayStation 5, which would be even more dramatic, I think. But it's a marvel, no pun intended, what they're able to accomplish on the current gen hardware, on this, you know, on this aged hardware, because the game looks great. You know, there's lots of shiny surfaces, and I can't wait to see how they look with ray tracing. But they basically do a lot of fake ray tracing in the game to make it look like, you know, all the buildings in Manhattan are reflecting lights and stuff. So I'm sure it'll be dramatic to see it for real. But I gotta say, if you only have a PlayStation 4, you're going to enjoy this game a lot. I don't think that the delta between PlayStation 4 and PlayStation 5 is going to be as dramatic as one might think. I think the PlayStation 4 experience, now, I haven't seen the PlayStation 5 experience firsthand, so maybe I will be more impressed, but I'm so impressed with the PlayStation 4 experience that I don't think that there's much headroom left to make it seem like you're really missing out if you're only able to play it on PlayStation 4. That is to say, it's a great game. You know, the storytelling that Insomniac has brought to these Spider-Man games is so wonderful. How they emphasized in the first game Peter Parker's life, not just Spider-Man's life. And again, they do that here with Miles Morales having this really interesting, vibrant personal life, family life, characters all around him as Miles Morales, not just as Spider-Man, that are interesting and fun and well performed. And My only qualm is it feels a little more rushed as a story than the first game was. And I wish it had more time to breathe. I feel like this game's story, I mean, you get these big revelations very fast. And most of them aren't particularly surprising if you're familiar with the character from the comics. But they still, I think, could have played more interesting if they weren't so rushed. I mean, just a couple of hours in, you've already got like, whoa, that person's that person and that person's this person. We're learning all these things. And I just felt like if we had a little more time to breathe, I thought the first game was paced very, very well in learning about Peter's life and getting comfortable with Doc Ock, for example, and before he ever becomes the supervillain. It was just such a wonderful slow burn. This game really doesn't do slow burn. It does very fast burn. but it also is still very enjoyable. It's just a delight to play this game. And Alex, I mean, I think as you were talking in the early part of this episode, talking about feel and all those tiny micro adjustments that are made, I just feel like Spider-Man is such a perfect example of that, to really highlight how the feel of something, like just the feel of swinging through Manhattan as Spider-Man, is perfect. Oh, one big thing that they've added in this game that I found to be very welcome and just cool and such a great idea is that now when you're swinging through the city, you have another button that you can hold down that basically lets you do like Tony Hawk style freestyle moves. Like you swing and then you let go of the web and you push the square button and then you can move the stick in a variety of directions. And he starts doing like, you know, flips and I don't know of any skateboarding terms, but like, you know, he'll hold his foot out like a skateboarding move, or, you know, he'll do an awesome like extreme sports flippity do, and then it'll give you points. It'll say like, great combo, you did three flips and a spinaroony or whatever, and then it'll give you like XP for just doing that. So literally as you're traversing through the city, you can get small amounts of XP by just like having fun and flipping around and experimenting and trying to pull off like six backflips before you hit the ground. It's just a like totally throwaway minor thing that adds a tremendous amount of fun just getting from place to place in this game. So
I'm glad because like the first game had, you could do some tricks. I've heard it's more extensive in this, but I do like that little XP boost, because before I would do it sometimes just for fun, right? But now It's like, oh, I'm going to be doing all of this. Two quickies. One, to your point about like the guards that kind of, you know, are matched to now your new skills. I'm curious to see how that plays out in Miles Morales. You've definitely, you know, we've seen it in other games, the first Spider-Man as well, and the Arkham games, and totally irrelevant to the gameplay, but from like the fictional world I've built out around these games, I do love the villains being like, you get the shield that can block his punch. You get the thing that can block his night vision.
Yeah.
You get nothing.
I'm not giving both to one guy either. Yeah.
Yeah. Can I have all of those things? No, Trevor. You get this box. Oh, I always get the box.
Yeah.
And then,
all right, we're all going to get in the van. We're going to pull up. As soon as Spider-Man tries to get away, we're going to pull up. We're going to leap out of the van. Yeah. Gary, you've got the AK-47. Lance, you've got the shield that can block his spider powers. Gary, you've got a baton. A baton? Yeah, a baton.
Yeah. We have all this gear that if one person wore it, we could defeat Spider-Man. I will give it to 10 of you. Good luck. Yeah. And I don't want spoilers here. Maybe I'll just limit this to a yes-no question. And maybe, I don't know if you've rolled credits or not, but my kids enjoyed watching me play the first one, and they watched a decent amount of it and some story levels. And then one night, I was playing without them, and I was glad I was playing without them, and then I limited it to they could only watch me play the open world segments, because there was one part in the first game, spoiler, where if I remember it correctly, like one of the scientists kills himself, and it was like very close to where my kids were watching. It was like, I'll finish later, and then it's like, I think like he gets mind control. I forget what happened, but I think he like takes a gun in one of those research tents and is like, blang, and I'm like, nope, is this? And like for me, it was fine, but so much of the game was like very, I felt, kid appropriate. We all draw our own lines as parents. But from you as a parent, like from the story perspective, is it, you know, air quote PG-13, like a hard PG-13, or does it feel a little lighter or about the same as the first one?
It feels a little lighter than the first one. I have not finished the game. I think I'm pretty close to the end. I was trying to finish before today, but I didn't manage it. It feels like I haven't seen anything that I would object to you showing your kids. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously I'm not you, but it has, like the first game, it has this wonderful focus on community service. Also, like Miles Morales, there's a big subplot and side quests about this food shelter that they're trying to save and that has been taken over by bad guys. There's a character that only speaks with ASL, American mm-hmm. Sign Language, and I thought that was pretty cool. And like Miles just knows ASL. I love that. You know, it's just feels very natural. And there's, I don't know, it's a very inclusive game in that way, and that's I think really positive. And there isn't anything that I found to be particularly jarring, other than, you know, bridges collapsing and people falling into the river and, you know, that kind of like superhero-y danger stuff.
Right, and bad guys have guns, but it's not like, yeah, it's not like Ghost Runner, I imagine. I might start with Open World and then see where the narrative goes in terms of letting them watch and play.
And cool. It's still they still retain the thing where if you kick a guy off of, you know, 40-story building, Spider-Man magically webs him to the side so he doesn't fall to his death, you know, that kind of thing. Which I really appreciate. I appreciate that extra mile of, you know, Spider-Man doesn't murder people. You know, I like that. But it's fantastic. You know, it doesn't feel less than the first game. There's a bit of redundancy. You know, it's not really rewriting or reinventing the wheel, but I don't think anybody expected it to. And it's fresh enough because of the new character and the new supporting characters that it does feel like a step forward in deepening this world. And and you know, it carries forward all of the stuff from the first game. So in that sense, it feels like a sequel. I don't know if people have played the first Spider-Man game, then you know that Miles Morales is in it a bit, and all of that stuff that happened in the first game happened in the history of this game. So it is a continuation of that story, and so it kind of feels like a sequel as well. It's a great, great game. My biggest shock, honestly, is that as one of the premier, you know, launch titles for a new console, how great it plays on the last console. Like, it plays great on PlayStation 4. And like I said, I haven't played it on PlayStation 5, so maybe I will change my tune when I have. But I have a hard time thinking anybody really needs the new console to play this particular game. You know, it's like you will enjoy this game on PlayStation 4. So. All right. You know, we're already running kind of long, but I kind of want to talk some VR with you, Alex. You got a few extra minutes?
Absolutely.
All right, let's do it. Virtual reality. VR. The first thing I want to ask you, as a developer, as a field developer, as a gameplay developer, are you excited about a potential VR future, or is it something that you think will remain niche?
That's a good question. I wonder personally, this is purely me as a gamer talking, I wonder if the full immersion, the shut out the world nature of VR is ever going to be that flexible. You know, like when I think about me with my kids and my fiance, you know, there's times where VR would be is a hard no, because I can't shut myself off from the world in order to play it. But that's also the reason why it's so great. You know, that is the reason why, you know, losing yourself in that world and being, you know, physically present in the world is incredible. What I will say as a developer, VR is, you know, it's that presence, that being in the world. I remember when I first got a headset and I only had 360 videos, I was like, meh, whatever. Like, yeah, okay, I can look around, don't care. And then I got my PSVR and I got Batman and I leaned forward and I looked over something and picked it up and was like, I'm in, right? That is that is the immersion that, you know, that is unparalleled, right? You can't get that. And I only have a PSVR. I'm not lucky enough to have the shiny PC stuff. I love my PSVR. I think it's super compelling and enjoyable. I've had a lot of fun playing. I've had a lot of fun doing the Sherpering that you love to do, Jeff. I think that is, I ran a bachelor party once that was basically a VR bachelor party and I was just a Sherper for like 4 hours, which was amazing. And then I wanted to quickly call back to the Room VR, which I think you guys talked about a while ago that my fiance and I played recently, and we sort of took turns to solve a puzzle each. And I really love the fact that the PSVR has both the person in VR's view, but also what they're seeing on the TV. So it was really helpful for puzzles to, be able to chat and talk about it and be a part of the experience, even though, a lot like Keep Talking and Nobody Explodes and many of those other games that kind of leverage the people outside of VR as well. So there is ways you can make it work in that way. It doesn't have to be entirely solitary. I think the physicality, the presence, the interaction, especially if a lot of the controllers get more haptics and, more of that level of, being able to sort of feel the world as you're touching it rather than kind of, bumping into it or cutting through it or clipping through it, I think will help. But I think VR is certainly something that I'm excited about and love to partake in. And I'm hopeful that some version of VR / AR will allow us to create these more immersive and more interactive worlds.
Yeah. Yeah. And you've been playing some Pixel Rift 1989, right?
So yeah, just quickly, the one VR experience I've been messing with this week is called Pixel Ripped 1989. Again, it appealed to me immediately as a retro nerd. It's very sort of old school retro feel. It's developed by a little Brazilian team in Sao Paulo called Avor Immersive Experiences. I watched a video of them, of those guys and their development team, and I felt very old because they were all, very young, very diverse, very, very kind of modern video game development team, which I'm super excited about. And it's kind of amazing that they've managed to make a game that an old one like me feels very at home in. What is it? It's basically a game in a game, another game in a game, where you predominantly are playing on a small handheld console called a Gear Kid, playing various levels of 8 and 16-bit video games whilst trying not to get caught by a teacher in school. And there's a whole narrative around, why you are this character and why you're playing this machine. And there's some interaction between the game world and the real world that you're in, none of which I want to spoil. All I'll say is that the way that it leverages both the controller that is, you are holding and can manipulate, and this interaction with the world, and the way that these 8-bit sprites can go from being on this little handheld machine to sometimes being in the world in front of you and getting some of that diorama stuff that, that you talk about, Jeff, about being so compelling. They capture that in a really interesting way, and they blend the mechanics between the two modes, this kind of platforming, simple platforming, and sort of bring it into this world in front of you as well as this world on this little handheld. It's really, really cool. It grabbed me right away. It was one of those ones where I turned it on at like 11:30 at night and was like, I'll play an hour or so of it. And then like at 2 a.m. I actually finished it. It's quite short. I think it's about 2.5-3 hours. But it's totally worth it. I picked it up on PSN sale, so I think I only paid $15 for it. It was totally worth it. There's also a sequel called Pixel Rip 1995, I believe, which I'm really excited to play, and I believe continues the narrative. Super cool, very much captures a lot of what you've talked about so great before, Jeff, about that, leveraging the benefit of VR, both things you can interact with and the world in front of you and the ways in which those two can overlap. And sometimes you're doing both, you're kind of playing the handheld and dealing with the world at the same time. It's really, really, really interesting. Really liked it.
Yeah, I agree. It's called Pixel Ripped 1989, and it does have a sequel. So good. And now knowing what I know about you and how much you love retro games, it does seem like the perfect game for you. It's just a love letter to retro games, you know, in a lot of ways. Yeah. I wanted to just quickly mention, one of the points that I had made when we were talking about Quest 2 a few weeks ago was how frustrated I was with the link cable experience. And I got a number of emails from folks suggesting I try the wireless streaming via virtual desktop. And I finally got around to doing that. And boy, it works great. It takes a bit of doing. It's not completely intuitive, a process. You have to purchase virtual desktop, which is, I think, $20 or $15 on your Oculus Quest. And you have to do a number of things on your PC. But it basically allows you to stream games, Steam VR games or Oculus Store games, from your PC to your headset. You have to have... There's a number of things that you need to have a smooth experience, one of which is the 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi band on your router. So not all routers have that. And you have to have a pretty fast PC. But I've got it to work, and it works great. I was playing Asgard's Wrath without a cable. Asgard's Wrath not supported on Quest, but I was playing it on my Quest 2 without a cable. It played great. It was super slick. Once you get through the initial setup, it works really, really seamlessly. And there's a number of guides you can find online that'll step you through the process of setting it up. It takes, I don't know, 20 minutes to set it up all told, download a few things, you have to spend some money, you know, spend $15 or whatever it is, $20 on virtual desktop. But after that, all the games that I had for my original Rift played great. And, you know, I haven't tested them all. There's a number of games that have some issues because this isn't officially supported by Oculus. It is a bit of a hack, but the games that I tried, Lone Echo and Asgard's Wrath, played really smoothly, and I didn't have any wires, nothing weighing me down. It was pretty amazing. No external cameras. Got to play on Quest with the OLED displays. Pretty darn cool. So I recommend people giving it a try.
Just curious, Jeff, did you notice any latency with that?
I didn't, but there are a number of settings that you can mess with the virtual desktop streaming software. There's you can set a cap for the number of frames per second. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, your results may vary. Also, your proximity to your router can affect it. My router happens to be in the room that I was playing it mm-hmm. on. So I wasn't like wandering around, you know, using the Quest as a, you know, completely seamless, completely untethered device, like walking into my backyard or anything. I was right next to my router, but I didn't have any cords. I didn't have any cables. And I thought that was great. So results may vary. It is, again, not an officially supported thing. And you may end up not being able to have the results I had. And I think there are a few games that actually have some stuttering issues. Like I hear that the Insomniac game Stormland doesn't work very well, which is a big bummer because that game is very good. But the two games that I tried this week both worked really, really well. So
yeah, it's interesting because I'm a big fan of PS Now and xCloud, and I've been wondering if PlayStation would brave putting some VR games on PS Now. Obviously, that's a step further yeah. away, right? The game's literally running elsewhere as opposed to just in your house. But right. that'd be really cool if they're able to figure that out, because you know, I've been super impressed with the way PS Now works. It's very seamless for me, and if it was possible yeah. to play a VR game without any lag, that would be cool.
Well, I think that's the future. I mean, that's one of the things I'm excited about with stuff like Stadia, is like at a certain point when we work out, you know, all the kinks and that stuff, and we work out broadband in this country, I think that's the idea, is that you can have, hopefully at some point, AR, VR glasses that are really lightweight, because there's basically no processor in them at all, because mm-hmm. it's all handled in the cloud, and it's literally just a display you put on your head. I'm excited for that version of it, but I don't think we're there yet.
Yes, yeah. please. Put that on my yes, face.
All right. This has been a fantastic episode, Alex. Thank you so much for being here. It's been such a joy.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
No, thank you. I've been a huge fan of this show, and you and Christian and Garnet back in the Weekend Confirmed days, and to be on the show is an honor. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I can't wait to have you back. Tell folks where they can keep up with you and the things that you do.
Yeah, mostly only on Twitter at Rambling Alex. You can also find me on Instagram, The Powdered Toast, Old Red and Stimpy reference. I don't have a whole lot of social media. I cut most of it out of my life a couple of years ago to try and help my level of distraction. But I still tweet here and there. And if you're curious about my retro collection and take a look on Instagram. There's some stuff that I built at Dice LA, which sadly I had to dismantle this week. I built a whole retro arcade that we had at the studio, and the studio was very generous in furnishing it and allowing me to run it. And I had 30 odd consoles set up and running and all the time. So that's how much of a retro nerd I am.
I have a garage, Alex. Like, it's not new. I mean, I'll stay outside. I'll wear a mask. You can bring it over and install it. I'll play it.
you can look after it for me
and diligently
play it. Yeah, that sounds great.
Christian Spicer, what about you? What do you got going on this week?
Well, Twitter's the best way, at Spicer. My plan, but these things can always change, but my plan, and part of the reason why I upgraded my streaming setup, my plan is when I get my PS5 to stream Miles Morales that Thursday, and then find a regular streaming schedule that I can actually stick with for a decent long enough haul. But the plan is, I thought about doing a reboxing video as everybody else was unboxing their new consoles. I was going to rebox my old ones.
It's fine.
But I'm picking up my PS5, I think at 6:30 in the morning. I did a Best Buy and they emailed out like, we're doing early morning, like come and get it safe from the store kind of thing. So I should hopefully have it set up early Thursday. And as soon as I can get that Miles Morales downloaded, playing and streaming. So that's twitch.tv/Christian Spicer. Which is also where I host usually just this show, 7:15 p.m. Pacific time. But Twitter will be where I'll blast out if I'm playing or not.
Very cool. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. You can also email us here on the show, dlcfeedback@gmail.com. We love hearing from you. We love hearing your feedback, hearing questions, comments, reviews, whatever you want to send us. We appreciate it. dlcfeedback@gmail.com. Also, I have several other shows for you to check out. If you want to listen to me talk about movies and TV shows, the Slash Filmcast is where you do that. We just launched a Patreon there where we added bonus content. We got some fun After Dark episodes where you hear us talking about other stuff too. So check out all that content at slashfilmcast.com. I also do a comedy science show with Anthony Carboni called We Have Concerns. Hear us talk about science and fill you in on some interesting news, some news that might not be politics. It's more interesting science news, but we make it funny. Wehaveconcerns.com. And then I also stream about sports, about football, in particular, a football league called Fan Controlled Football, which is basically Madden in real life. Do that on Thursdays at 3 p.m. Pacific time at twitch.tv/FCF for Fan Controlled Football. Doing that with Josh McCuga and Patrick Dees, who's been on the show before. It's a lot of fun. Check that out. And then the Dungeon Run, which is my long form Dungeons and Dragons show. Doing some wacky, wild, awesome stuff over there. Really cool episode last week. Check that out. You can find it on YouTube by searching for the Dungeon Run, or as an audio podcast by searching for the Dungeon Run there, or by watching live Wednesday nights at 6 p.m. Pacific time at caffeine.tv/The Dungeon Run.
Just quickly, Jeff, as someone that grew up in England and didn't really play D&D, but has a lot of people in my industry that always talk about how they're only in the industry because they play D&D, I've always felt very weird about D&D. I'm like, I don't really know it, but people love it. Your show has been a brilliant way of learning about D&D, and the fact that you're able to put that together and execute it every week blows my mind. So,
Wow, thank you. I'm so pleased to hear that. Thanks for saying that. I appreciate that. I'm very proud of the show, and I really, really love it. It's a ton of work, but I love it. So anytime I hear anybody say something like that, it makes me feel great. So thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Let's wrap the show up now with our parting gifts.
Hey, give us a suggestion.
Alex, do you have a suggestion to help people get through their week?
I do. So I was going to do two, but I'm going to stick to one given the time. I had one silly and one important. I'm going to try and do the important one. I, as you might be able to tell, as someone from Britain, was super skeptical about counseling or therapy. I grew up in a country that doesn't really believe in it, and obviously this country does. When I moved over here, I went through a very tricky divorce, and actually took on some therapy in order to try and understand some of my actions, and found it very, very helpful. And I'm doing it again now, the current time and current climate, current all the stuff that's been going on. It's helpful, I think, to be able to talk to someone about it, someone who's, you know, open and a neutral party. So my part and gift is tell someone about something that you wouldn't really normally want to tell them about. It can be a friend. You can tell a friend about something something you did that you're ashamed of that you still hold on to. I've done that with a couple of my friends, and we have a bit better relationship as a result of it. I very much value those friends that were there for me and listened to me through some of those things and checked me and checked my behavior at times. I really appreciate that. Reach out to a parent, particularly at these times when you can be at odds with a parent and maybe you don't philosophically see eye to eye anymore like you used to. Try and understand their perspective. Try and talk to them about what you're struggling with. Maybe it's your partner. Maybe it's a helpline, right? Or maybe it's therapy. Talk to someone. Your mental health, your brain chemistry, as I always say, is super important. It's really easy to underestimate how much it can affect your behavior, your thoughts, your processes. As a creative, it has a big impact on my creative drive, and it's one that I try and treat very carefully, and try and stay open to learning some nasty truths that will help you to be better. So that's my parting gift.
Great advice. Great advice indeed. I appreciate that. Christian Spicer, what about you? You got a parting gift?
I do. Not as doesn't need to be listened to as seriously as what Alex said, because that is much more important. I guess my only addendum to that would be like, don't do Ozark season 3 if you're going to do it. Like, really do it.
True.
My parting gift would be, and I always feel like I get her last name wrong, Kylie Minogue, I think is how you pronounce her last name. Like, she's been around forever and I've never taken the time to like
double Minogue.
Check. Minogue?
Yeah, Kylie Minogue. Yes.
Yeah.
Minogue. Got it. Kylie Minogue, she has a new album out, Disco. It is incredible. She's been a queen of pop for so long. Mm-hmm. And that to have this new album come out now, it reminds me a lot of Lady Gaga's album when it came out this year, where it's like, the year's bad, you're in your house, you still got to dance, you got to move. Disco is so incredible. It's been on repeat in our house all weekend. Pick it up, go to your streaming service of choice, listen to it. I cannot recommend it enough. She is just constant hit maker, and Disco is full of them.
Very cool. Kylie Minogue's Disco. I'm going to suggest a podcast that I should have suggested a long time ago. I don't think I've ever brought it up on the show, but a friend of the show and my friend, Danish Syed, and his buddies, Matt Pearson and Jeff Larkin, do a great podcast called Someone Should Make This. And we've been talking game design and game designers. Danish works at a studio as well. And these three dudes and their guests talk about ideas that they think someone should make. And it is delightful to listen to. They have such fantastic ideas. Sometimes the ideas are crazy and silly and kind of dumb in the best possible way. Other times the ideas are like, yes, someone absolutely needs to make that because it's incredible. And it ranges the whole gamut in between. But what you will always know is that it is entertaining. Those guys are charming. It is a lot of fun to listen to. So check out Someone Should Make This wherever you get podcasts. I highly recommend it. It's a lot of fun. We also got a listener suggested parting gift. This comes from another friend of the show who's been a guest multiple times. Our friend Patrick Beja sent us a parting gift. Patrick says, it's the book Factfulness by Hans Rosling, the guy who did that amazing TED Talk with moving graphs in 2006, which I'm sure you've seen. I listened to it over the past week in an attempt to escape the madness. And to my surprise, it was the most calming and reassuring experience I could hope for. It was also illuminating, as it details a fact-based worldview in a fun, entertaining, and truly fascinating way. It turns out that we do not understand how things actually are. Really, most of us, no matter our background, actually have a very skewed understanding of today's world. In most cases, the reality is positive and hopeful because things are getting a lot better. Not everything is good, of course, but the book doesn't shy away from that. But it helps us understand things in a truly rational way, which I think is what we desperately need. I really hope that you'll read it, because I know you'll find it useful, helpful, and fun. Many good thoughts, Patrick. Thank you, Patrick. Again, that book is called Factfulness by Hans Rosling. Sounds like one I would definitely enjoy. All right. That is going to do it for this episode of DLC. Thanks again to Alex Solman and Christian Spicer for hanging out with me. Thanks to our musical contributors, Patrick L., Sean Madigan, and Zero Star for making those bumpers. Thanks to all the folks listening live in our chat room. We appreciate you. And thank you to each and every one of you. I appreciate you. And I'm excited for the next generation. Let's just say that. Until next week. Think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.